CBS News Face the Nation in 60 seconds.
In 2001, Vonage revolutionized home phone service with voice over internet. After such a colossal breakthrough, who would have objected if Vonage said, "Enjoy better, world. Vonage will be spending some me time at the spa." But the thing about better is, there's always more better. So today, Vonage is not at the spa having its trouble area worked on by a masseuse named Moonshadow, but with its nose to the grindstone, transforming communications for your business by making it better. With a cloud-based infrastructure that grows as your business grows. Seamless mobility between all devices so you don't miss that important call, even while Moonshadow is walking down your spine. And all for less than you think. So while you're getting your mani-pedi, Vonage's toenails remain a complete disaster, because Vonage is still out there working to make more better. See how your business can get the better it deserves. Call Vonage at 1-800-5-VONAGE or go to Vonage.com. Vonage, the business of better.
Today on Face the Nation, House Speaker John Boehner. He stunned the political world by announcing he's quitting Congress. He's here to tell us why. John Boehner was all smiles when he met reporters after his bombshell announcement.
This turmoil that's been churning now for a couple of months is not good for the members and it's not good for the institutions.
But will his stepping down fix the chaos in Congress? Speaker Boehner is here with us to talk about his decision and what impact that emotional day with the Pope had on him. Plus, we'll talk with Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders and longtime Boehner friend and Republican candidate Ohio Governor John Kasich. We'll have political analysis and take a look at how, just for a moment, it wasn't business as usual in Washington. It's all coming up on Face the Nation. Good morning and welcome to Face the Nation. I'm John Dickerson. Speaker John Boehner is with us. This interview had been planned for some time. We were originally going to talk about the Pope's visit, and we will. But first, there's that big announcement you made Friday. And so I want to talk to you about that. But let's get right to the news. 4 days, the government runs out of money. Is there going to be a shutdown?
No. The Senate is expected to pass a continuing resolution next week. The House will take up the Senate bill. We'll also take up a select committee to investigate these horrific videos that we've seen from abortion clinics in several states that really raise questions about the use of federal funds and raise questions about aborted fetuses that are born alive.
The continuing resolution, will that require Democratic votes to pass?
I'm sure it will, but I expect my Democrat colleagues want to keep the government open as much as I do.
And what about the rest of the business you want to get done before October 30th? What's on the to-do list?
Well, I've got another 30 days to be Speaker, and I'm going to make the same decisions the same way I have over the last 4.5 years to make sure that we're passing conservative legislation that is good for the country. So I expect that we might have a little more cooperation from some around town to try to get as much finished as possible. I don't want to leave my successor a dirty barn. So I want to clean the barn up a little bit before the next person gets there.
Well, let's talk about the state of the barn and its relative cleanliness. A lot of your colleagues I've talked to and friends who served with you use the word dysfunction and say basically that you had to resign because it's a sign of how dysfunctional things are in the House with Republicans. What do you say to
that? Well, I wouldn't call it dysfunction. Disagreement, yes. As I said on Friday, I was planning on leaving at the end of last year. And when my friend Eric Cantor lost his primary election in July of last year, it was clear to me that I just couldn't leave, that I had to provide a transition for the next leaders. So I planned on serving through this year. And on November 17th, I was going to make an announcement. And on Thursday evening and Friday morning, I looked up and went, why do I want to put my colleagues through this when I'm going to make the same announcement 6 weeks from now? Why do I want to put the institution through this? And so it was the right decision. I thought we handled it the right way.
When you talk about the decision that they were going to have to go through, it was going to be a pretty messy...
A motion to vacate the chair.
Yeah. So, and kick you out of your job, to help people at home who don't understand what vacating the chair
is. Listen, winning that vote was never an issue. I was going to get the overwhelming number of, I'd have gotten 400 votes probably. But why do I want to make my members, Republican members, like walk the plank? Because they're going to get criticized at home by some who were, you know, who think that we ought to be more aggressive. Mm-hmm. Listen, we've accomplished a lot over the 4.5 years that I was Speaker. And whether it was the largest deficit reduction deal in the history of the country, saving $2.1 trillion, protecting 99% of the American people from an increase in our taxes, or the first major entitlement reforms in 20 years. All done over the last 4.5 years with a Democrat president and all voted against by my most conservative members because it wasn't good enough. Really? This is the part that I really don't understand. You know, our founders gave us the system of government, a majority in the House. But you need 60 votes in the Senate. Then, you know, if the House and the Senate can agree, the president gets to decide. And our founders didn't want some parliamentary system where if you won the majority, you got to do whatever you wanted. They wanted this long, slow process. And so change comes slowly. And obviously, too slowly for some.
Well, are they unrealistic about what can be done in government? That's the assumption.
Absolutely, they're unrealistic. You know, the Bible says, beware of false prophets. And there are people out there, you know, spreading noise about how much can get done. I mean, this whole idea that we're going to shut down the government to get rid of Obamacare in 2013, this plan never had a chance. But over the course of the August recess in 2013 and the course of September, you know, a lot of my Republican colleagues who knew it was a fool's errand, really, they were getting all this pressure from home to do this. And so we got groups here in town, members of the House and Senate here in town, who whip people into a frenzy believing they can accomplish things that they know are never going to happen. It's just, but listen, I've had 25 great years here in Washington. I've had great staff. I've had great colleagues. And I'm very thankful to my family and to my constituents for giving me the honor to do this.
Is Ted Cruz a false prophet?
Listen, you can pick a lot of names out. I'll let you choose them.
You don't debate that assertion?
I'll refer you to my remark at a fundraiser I made in August in Steamboat Springs, Colorado.
Let me put up a picture of you as a member of the Gang of Seven 25 years ago. You are the last member of the Gang of Seven still serving. You were a rabble-rouser then. You got some things changed in Republican leadership. Do you see any of yourself in these current conservatives who are giving you grief now?
No, I was a rebel. And it wasn't about shaking up the Republican leadership. It was about shaking up the House. The House was run, as one Democrat chairman called it, the last plantation in America. And whether it was the House bank scandal, the restaurant scandal, the post office scandal, sent my share of members to jail over improper activities in the House. But out of that, we began to question how the House itself was being run, the floor of the House. Helped us write the contract with America, helped us get into the majority, and it's been a great run.
Let me ask you about the by the way, you called Ted, I believe the word you used was jackass, referring to Senator
Cruz. I'm referring to that same remark.
All right. We've buttoned that up for the American people. Pope Francis, switching to a much more bigger topic here. What was a bigger accomplishment for you, becoming named Speaker or having the Pope come as your guest?
The kid who grew up as an altar boy, having the Pope here was a big deal. And I've tried over the last 20 years with the last three popes to get them to come and address a joint session of Congress. I'll never forget the first time I did this, back in 1995 or 6, it somehow showed up in the press, and my mother called me. Still alive then, and my mother never called me. And so I answered the phone. John, it's your mother. Now listen, I see you're inviting the Pope. If he comes, I'm there. You got it? Yes, Mom, I got it.
She was with you there this time.
Well, looking from above.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Tell me about that day, the impression it left on you. I mean, it's a big deal having him come, but then you're in his presence.
Yes. So we had a nice greeting when he came to the Capitol, and once the cameras were gone and The Pope sat down. I said, your Holy Father, I said, you're on Boehner time. He looked at me kind of funny. And I said, that means you're on time or you're early. And you're early. But we had a wonderful chat. And Father, or Cardinal Wuerl and myself, I got into a conversation with the Pope about our commitment to kids and education. So, and then the meeting broke up, and my family came in. And my 6-week-old grandson, Alistair, was blessed by the Pope. A very nice moment.
You told another story about what the Pope said to you about prayer.
Yeah, we had left the balcony where the Pope had addressed all the people on the west front of the Capitol, and we came through my office, and the Pope went down to the first floor on my elevator, and I took the British steps down to the first floor. And in what we now call Freedom Foyer, I was standing there with the Pope, and the cardinals and the rest of his entourage were all moving out to their vehicles, and the Pope takes his left arm and grabs my left arm and pulls me near him saying really nice words. I would repeat them, except it would really cause me to cry. And then he put his arm around me and pulled me right into him and said, please pray for me. Well, you can imagine.
Yeah.
And I was a mess.
Yeah.
Who am I? Pray for the Pope.
Yeah.
But I did.
You did. There is a belief in the Catholic Church that the Holy Spirit can move us. Did it, after that visit, to make this decision for you?
Well, I think it helped clear the picture. I never related one of these instances with the other, but clearly by Friday night it was pretty obvious to me that, I think it's time to do this.
And so you woke up Friday morning and...
Woke up Friday morning, walked up to Starbucks and back, and walked to Pete's and back, my regular jaunts in the morning. At 7:45 Friday morning, I said, yep, it's time to do this. Yeah.
So in a year or so, you'll be back in Statuary Hall for the unveiling of your portrait. And what do you want them to say about you at that ceremony?
He was a good man.
That's it?
That's all.
Yeah. And do you have anything that you can say now that you're headed out the door that you wouldn't have said if you had to go through another election?
No. I love my colleagues. I even love the ones that may disagree with me, Republicans or Democrats. I love my colleagues. I love the institution. And, I try to do the right thing every day. I'm a pretty simple guy. I just try to do the right things for the right reasons, and the right things will happen.
Tell us about your thoughts about President Obama. You worked on that that grand bargain. It didn't come through. Reflect on that for a minute.
Yeah, it's probably one of the biggest disappointments in my speakership. We were so close to having... We had an agreement. And then 2 days later, the president walked away from it. It would have saved about $5 trillion over 10 years. It had been good for our economy. It had been good for the country. It had been good for our kids and our grandkids. It's Washington. Things happen, and we move on. A nice conversation with President Obama on Friday morning. Nice conversation with one of my dear friends, George W. Bush, and all my legislative colleagues, the leaders.
What advice do you leave for your successor about the job?
Just do the right things for the right reasons. If you keep the country's best interest in mind and have the courage to do what you can do. And it's easy to have the courage to do what you can't do, but to have the courage to do what you can do, just go do it. In our system of government, it's not about Hail Mary passes. It's the Woody Hayes school of football. 3 yards and a cloud of dust. 3 yards and a cloud of dust. It's a slow, methodical process.
I want to ask you one last. What are you going to do now? By the way,
I don't know. I haven't had time to think about it. I made this decision, and we'll figure it out.
One thing that I heard a rumor about that you might be able to admit now that you're leaving. Do you do yoga?
I do. I'm not as diligent about lately as I used to over a year ago, but I do. As a matter of fact, I thought about it this morning because it's great for my back. I've had back problems for 50 years. But the older you get, all those tendons, muscles, they all want to tighten up. It's good to stretch them out.
Yeah. It helps the golf game?
It does.
All right. Speaker John Boehner, thanks so much for being with us.
Nice to be with you.
We hope to see you again, by the way. You'll come back in retirement?
We'll see.
Yeah. There'll be lots to talk about. We'll be back in a minute with Democratic candidate Senator Bernie Sanders.
Do you want to learn how to mask your identity to browse inappropriate websites and stream media while at the office?
Well, we can't help you with that. But among the many IT problems we solve, Barracuda's web security solutions keep online activity clean and ensure internet bandwidth performance. Reclaim your network, like 150,000 other businesses already have. To learn more about preventing web-based threats, visit barracuda.com/web.
Joining us now from Des Moines, Iowa, is Democratic presidential candidate and Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. Welcome, Senator Sanders. I just wanted to get your reaction to John Boehner's news this week. You came to Congress with him at the same time.
Well, John has had an impossibly difficult job trying to reconcile the conservative wing of his caucus with the extreme, extreme right wing of his caucus that really will not do anything and pass any legislation that Barack Obama will sign. It's an impossible job, and I admire John for his tenacity and hanging in there for five tough years.
Let me ask you about another piece of news this week. Scott Walker folded his campaign. You've talked a great deal about the billionaire class that influences politics by giving money to candidates. The Koch brothers were big fans of Scott Walker's. He had a lot of money in his super PAC, and yet he disappeared from the presidential race. Is that a rebuttal to your argument that big money just totally calls the tune in politics?
Well, I wish it were, and I wish that the Koch brothers would say, well, gee, now we're going to take the $900 million that we plan to spend in this campaign supporting right-wing Republicans, more, by the way, than either the Democratic Party or the Republican Party will spend, and we're not going to spend it. But, John, I don't think the Koch brothers learned that lesson. I think the power of money over the political process is horrendous. I think that super PACs are playing a very, very destructive role in our political system. And I will do, if president, everything that I can to see that this disastrous Citizens United Supreme Court decision is overturned. American democracy is not about billionaires buying elections or trying to buy elections.
You did something politicians don't normally do, which is go into an audience that is not there just to applaud you automatically. You went to Liberty University, fundamentalist Christian university, and you brought your same message. One of the things you said was that the audience, you knew you had a disagreement on the question of abortion and on same-sex marriage, but you asked them to put those disagreements aside and focus on the priority, which is the inequities in the economic system. Would you have the same message for liberals that on those issues that really stop the fighting about those and focus on the big thing, which is the economic inequality?
Well, look, this is what I said at Liberty, and this is what I believe. I am pro-choice. I've always been pro-choice. I am strongly in favor of gay marriage. And I know that at Liberty University, people there have honest disagreements with me on that issue. But what I said, look, at a time when we have a grotesque level of income and wealth inequality, when almost all of the new income and wealth in this country is going to the top 1%, when we have the highest rate of childhood poverty of any major country on earth, when many, many millions of Americans are working two or three jobs just to sustain themselves, can we not get together and talk about creating an economy that works for all of us and not just millionaires and billionaires? When children go hungry in America, that is a moral issue. When 51% of African-American kids are either unemployed or underemployed, that is a moral issue. And I know that at Liberty University, and among the evangelical community, you have some very sincere, honest people who take these issues seriously. And by the way, many of them are concerned, as Pope Francis is, about climate change and the need to transform our energy system away from fossil fuel. They believe that the earth created by God cannot be destroyed by greed. And my question was, can we work together to address those issues?
I'd like to play something for you that Jeb Bush said out on the campaign trail this week and get your reaction to it.
Our message is one of hope and aspiration. It isn't one of division and get in line and we'll take care of you with free stuff. Our message is one that is uplifting, that says you can achieve earned success.
That's a kind of argument that will be used against you if you get the nomination. The idea that you're promising health care for all and free college. It's a bunch of free stuff. It's unrealistic. What's your reaction?
Well, let's be clear that what Jeb Bush is proposing are massive tax breaks for the richest people in this country, while he will fight to cut Social Security and Medicare and programs that tens of millions of elderly people and middle-class people and working-class people depend upon. I happen to believe, John, that in a democratic, civilized society, all people should be entitled to health care as a right. Yeah, I do believe that. Is this a radical idea? No, it's not. Every other major industrialized country on earth does the same. Yes, I believe that it is absurd that in a highly competitive global economy, we got hundreds of thousands of bright young people who are qualified to go to college but can't because their families lack the income. So yes, I do believe that public colleges and universities should be tuition free. Is this a radical idea? Well, gee, Germany does it. Other countries around the world do that because they know investing in their kids is good for their economy. And by the way, we're going to pay for that by a tax on Wall Street speculation.
If I may pick up on that point about free college, Hillary Clinton weighed in on free college. Let's listen to what she said, and I'll get your reaction.
I am not going to give, you know, free college to wealthy kids. I'm not going to give free college to kids who don't work some hours to try to put, you know, their own effort into getting their education.
So what's your reaction to that critique, Senator?
Well, my reaction is that I think if you look at my agenda, the wealthy people are not particularly supportive of it because we are going to ask the wealthiest people in this country to pay substantially more in taxes because we have a situation where they're earning almost all of the new income. We are going to ask large corporations, profitable corporations that in some cases pay zero in federal income taxes to start paying their fair share of taxes. But I do believe that we need a system which is not free college education for all. It is free tuition in public colleges and universities. I think it is simple. It is straightforward. It exists in other countries. And in fact, John, 50 or 60 years ago, it used to exist in the United States of America.
Hillary Clinton, when I spoke to her last week, said she had, quote, no interest in attacking you. You've said you won't attack her. Do you take her at her word?
Well, I certainly do, and I hope that that will be the case. Look, I think one of the reasons our campaign is doing well is we are focusing on the real issues that impact the middle class and working families of this country. The decline of the middle class, income and wealth inequality, climate change, a corrupt campaign finance system, affordability of college, et cetera, et cetera. That's what I do. I happen to have known Hillary Clinton for the last 25 years. I respect her. I admire her. I'm not going to get into the business of attacking her. I've never run a negative political ad in my life. Ask the people of Vermont, and they will tell you a lot of very ugly ads have been run against me. I've never run a negative ad in my life. So I hope that in this campaign we can have a civil discourse discussing our differences of opinion, which are many, on the important issues facing our country. I think that is what the American people want us to do.
What about her super PAC that ads? Do you think that her promise extends to those?
Well, I would certainly hope so.
Let me ask you one then final quickly before we have about 20 seconds. What's the status of the debates? You'd like to see more of them? Is there any chance there are going to be more Democratic debates?
I have the feeling that there will be. I think debates are a good way for candidates to differentiate their differences. I think it's good for the American people. I think it promotes a serious discussion in our democracy, and I would like to see more of them.
All right, excellent. Senator Bernie Sanders, thank you so much for being with us. We'll look forward to seeing you again, and we'll be back in a moment.
In 2001, Vonage revolutionized home phone service with voice over internet. After such a colossal breakthrough, who would have objected if Vonage said, "Enjoy better, world. Vonage will be spending some me time at the spa." But the thing about better is, there's always more better. So today, Vonage is not at the spa having its trouble area worked on by a masseuse named Moonshadow, but with its nose to the grindstone, transforming communications for your business by making it better. With a cloud-based infrastructure that grows as your business grows. Seamless mobility between all devices so you don't miss that important call, even while Moonshadow is walking down your spine. And all for less than you think. So while you're getting your mani-pedi, Vonage's toenails remain a complete disaster, because Vonage is still out there working to make more better. See how your business can get the better it deserves. Call Vonage at 1-800-5-VONAGE or go to Vonage.com. Vonage, the business of better.
When Pope Francis spoke to a joint session of Congress on Thursday, he urged his audience to see the humanity in others. They seemed to agree so heartily with the sentiment that when he tried to recite the Golden Rule, they interrupted him before he could finish.
Do unto others as you...
Was it possible that the grip of politics had been loosened? Imagine the work that could get done if ideological foes recognized the good in their adversaries. How long would it last? Days? Weeks? Months? The answer? Less than 24 hours.
Just a few minutes ago, Speaker Boehner announced that he will be resigning.
That was not applause for John Boehner's years of service. It was a part of what one Boehner colleague called an unseemly competition of grave dancing. And it wasn't Democrats doing the cheering. It was members of Boehner's own party.
That's good. That's one down. That's 434 more to go before we're done.
You want to know how much each of you terrify Washington? Yesterday, John Boehner was Speaker of the House. Y'all come to town and somehow that changes.
Congressman Steve Stockman tweeted, "It looks like Christmas is coming early this year. Speaker Boehner to resign from Congress in October." Congressman Ted Yoho told the Gainesville Sun, "It couldn't be a better day politically for us." It took John Boehner 20 years to convince a pope to come to Congress. Francis spoke of mercy and dignity for the flawed. It left an indelible mark on the speaker, but not on his opponents. We've had a little technical problem with Governor Kasich, so we're going to start with our panel. Kim Strassel is with the Wall Street Journal. Susan Page is with the USA Today. Ed O'Keefe writes for the Washington Post. And our own Nancy Cordes of CBS News. Kim, I want to start with you. What is the Boehner, put the Boehner decision in context, the larger context of the Republican Party for me?
Well, he's being put out there as a scapegoat for all the frustrations that conservatives feel about what they haven't got done. I mean, probably the bigger scapegoat, if you want, and what ought to be Mitt Romney, in that he failed to win the presidency in 2012. And he left President Obama with a veto pen. And from the minute that that happened, what was very clear is that they were never going to get through anything that rolled back the Obama agenda. And they've been hitting their heads on the wall ever since. I think the real measure of how you would look at Boehner's tenureship there ought to be not what they managed to roll back, but what they stopped, because that's fundamentally why they were sent there. And it was 2 years into the Obama presidency. There was plenty more the president wanted to do, a lot more spending, a climate change bill, all kinds of things. And they did manage to stop that. But they were never going to be able to force him to give up on his agenda.
Yeah. Nancy, the speaker said false prophets. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty tough. We've seen him bristle. But false prophets is pretty, it's about as hard as he's been on the conservatives inside and outside of the House.
Yes, and I think what always really frustrated him was not just that he felt that their agenda was unrealistic, but that they knew that it was unrealistic and that they pushed more naive members towards it anyway and basically set up a no-win situation where they tried to gain these symbolic victories that just put them at a tactical disadvantage at the end. So he was always trying to convince his members, trying to educate them, that's a word he used a lot, to play the long game, to be tactical. That's a reason that he stuck around as long as he did through all the ups and downs, because he was a really tactical guy. And it was very frustrating to watch a lot of these members celebrate some of these short-term gains. And in fact, on Friday, an ally of his told me that this, even pushing him out, is kind of a symbolic victory that will set them back in the end. Because even if they didn't agree with Boehner, at least he was willing to take a lot of slings and arrows for them. He didn't have anything left to prove. And the next speaker may not be as thick-skinned as he was.
Susan, I want to ask you, I've heard two things in my reporting with members on the Hill. One group, the conservatives, say we are on the rise here, and the next speaker is going to have to listen to us, and we've got a list of demands. And then there's another group of Boehner allies who say the conservatives are going to have to be chastened, because there's no way they're going to kick out two speakers in a row. In other words, if the next speaker doesn't deliver, they'll try and go for him as well. What's your sense of how it plays out going forward?
Yeah, I think that's like whistling past the graveyard. I mean, the last six speakers have all left, not of their own devices. I mean, it seems to me that the most conservative forces in the House are emboldened by what's happened to John Boehner. And this creates, I think, a very difficult situation for the next speaker, probably Kevin McCarthy, and for Republicans who are running for president, because they're going to, we already see this in the Republican presidential contest, where the rise of the outsiders create enormous problems for people who we think are more realistic nominees, like Jeb Bush or Marco Rubio. So this is a story that is not finished with John Boehner leaving at the end of next month. This is a story that's going to be unfolding over the next year.
Ed, let me ask you, one of the arguments conservatives made for why John Boehner let them down is they said he didn't take on Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, enough. They want the new speaker to beat up on McConnell and say, stop letting Democrats filibuster you. How much control does the Speaker of the House have over the Majority Leader of the Senate? And how realistic is that as a set of demands? Because it's not just, I mean, it's in the grassroots as well, that they think the Speaker should be fighting with McConnell more. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, Boehner and McConnell certainly enjoyed a good relationship, and made it clear from the beginning of this year, when Republicans retook control of the Senate, that they would work much more closely. I think we've seen some disagreements over the summer on tactics and how to proceed. I'm struck by not only rank-and-file Republicans and Republican lawmakers, but now also Republican presidential candidates saying, let's erase the rules of the Senate, let's just get rid of this filibuster rule, and let's try to get things done. McConnell has stood firm on the idea that absent 60 votes on the Republican side, you're not going to get this legislation through. He's standing by it. There's no reason to believe he's going to change suddenly because John Boehner no longer has a job.
Nancy, what do you think the message is for Mitch McConnell over in the Senate?
Well, you know, I think it was interesting. Mitch McConnell said point blank on Friday how disappointed he was, because at least he knew that John Boehner was a straight shooter. And even the Democratic leaders, and nobody seemed more disappointed than them. Nancy Pelosi, Harry Reid said, it can't be overstated how much I am going to miss John Boehner, because he had to wrangle this very restless conference, a multi-headed beast, if you will, and he never overpromised. He really said, you know, this is what I can do, and they're going to miss that.
We now hear that the House Republicans are going to have this extended conference where they talk about, hopefully, not what leader they want, but what they want out of a leader. Because if they've got two brain cells to rub together, they're going to look at this and realize they can spend the next year beating their heads in the wall over whether or not they can defund Planned Parenthood, or they can decide that if they really actually want to get something done, they're going to pick the battles that they have and do the investigations that they can do and put out a message that is going to help them keep the House and keep the Senate and put a Republican in the White House, because that in the end is the only way they ever accomplish the things that they say they want to accomplish.
But how do they do that, Susan, in a presidential context where, as we've been discussing, you have candidates out there who are running against that, just precisely what Kim outlined, and who will continue being what John Boehner called the false prophets?
You know, the energy of the party is not behind the people who want to do that. Let's have a very sensible plan. Let's pick our fights. The energy of the Republican Party is, let's battle. let's call to arms, right? It's not worked for us. We aren't doing, we keep winning elections and we keep not getting the results that we want to see. So I think it is that these forces have been unleashed. I think it is unlikely that if things are going to get done, it's going to be done in the next 30 days by John Boehner deciding, I'm going to pass some stuff that my folks might not like, that put to clean out the barn, as he said in his interview with you. I mean, does he go for a longer funding bill so you don't have a crisis on December 11th? Does he try to pass the infrastructure bill that's been stalled? Does he choose to do that, which he'll have to do with Democratic votes?
I will say that Kevin McCarthy, who looks like he's most likely to be the next speaker, does probably have a better relationship with this crowd, the Freedom Caucus, if you will, than Boehner did, simply because generationally he's closer to them. He's only been in Congress since 2007, and he worked to get a lot of them elected.
I want to switch to the 2016 race for the presidency. On the Republican side, you've had two governors of experience that are now gone. Rick Perry, Scott Walker left last week. What does this say about where the race is right now?
Well, it says something about them. I mean, Scott Walker turned out not to be as good a candidate as everyone expected him to be, and Rick Perry never got over the problems from the impression that he left the last time he ran. But it also says something about the state of the Republican Party, that two experienced governors from significant states are out, and meanwhile, a retired neurosurgeon, a former CEO, and a celebrity billionaire are still in the race and in the hunt. It tells you something about the mood of the Republican electorate, which is, we don't like what we've been seeing. We are willing to entertain candidates that seem quite extraordinary.
Kim, what does somebody do to get in that conversation who has the apparent disadvantage of having been in politics in their life?
But I think you are seeing that. Look, I mean, some of Scott Walker's support appears to have gone to Marco Rubio, who, by the way, has been in politics his entire life. So what you're actually seeing here, I think there's some other lessons as well. It's that a lot of talk about super PACs. One of the reasons that you had 17 people in the Republican field, we find out that, in fact, that alone cannot actually get you over the finish line. You actually have to be a good candidate. And I think what you're going to see is that you're going to probably have some more people drop out there. And that's probably good for the field because it's allowing focus to go, and you're seeing some people begin to congeal around the top and make their way up, and you're probably going to have a better debate going forward as a result of this.
And I think in part their resumes are the reason that they got out so early, because Rick Perry and Scott Walker said, hey, if I'm at 1 or 2% and I'm clearly not going to be president, I've got better things to do. There are a lot of other people who are at 1 or 2% who maybe don't have as much going on, and so it behooves them to stay in the race.
And this will be a big week for candidates on both sides, of course, because the fundraising quarter comes to an end Tuesday night into Wednesday. I suspect in the next few days after that, we will begin to hear rumblings that there are some who ran out of money and simply can't continue going. But we've seen, you know, Hillary Clinton, we've seen Jeb Bush, we've seen a few others really put pedal to the metal and raise as much as possible to try to silence the critics, silence other potential opponents from getting into this.
Because their fundraising numbers will be a proxy for how they're doing
exactly.
In life.
And you're seeing some of the shine come off, too, some of those outsiders. I mean, Donald Trump did not have a good week following that debate. His poll numbers have been going down. You see it go to other people. Some of it's going to Carly Fiorina, but some of it's going to some of those candidates that you mentioned that have been in politics their whole life. And that's in part because they're also beginning to put out policy proposals that are getting some voter attention as well.
Susan, where is Jeb Bush in all of this? Not in the conversation as much as he probably would like.
Well, no, he's down in single digits. He needs to win. Someplace, maybe New Hampshire. He's not doing well there. I think he is. You talked about money's not everything. Money is not everything, but money is something. Mm-hmm. And he does have a fair amount of money. He has a lot of experience, personal and familial, in running these elections. So he is not one of those people I think is at risk of dropping out. He does need to do better. The debates, he's been disappointing in the debates. He was a little better in the second debate than he was in the first one. But he needs to show a little more passion. He needs to be a little more like his brother when it comes to getting attacked and getting back in a cutting way.
I want to switch to the Democrats quickly with the minutes we've got left. Nancy, another person who's going to do well with fundraising is probably Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. But more questions about email this week. What's the state of her campaign, do you think, at this moment?
You know, I think she's trying to talk about this as much as she can, sort of take some of the air out of the balloon. They found that when she wasn't answering these questions, it was making it look like she was stonewalling, like she had something to hide. So now she's answering more questions, and she's admitting that to a large degree this is now out of her control, which is something you never want to have to admit if you're a candidate. You'd like to have everything be under your control, but, you know, the FBI inquiry continues. She has no control over that. The Benghazi committee is going to be calling her before them to testify next month. You know, she has no idea what they're going to ask her or how that's going to go. And now the State Department and intelligence officials are starting to find more emails that she had not handed over. And there are some questions about when those emails were sent and why they weren't in the original batch. So, you know, she's doing what she can, which is to answer the questions and try to move forward. But, you know, it's definitely going to be an ongoing challenge for her throughout Election Day.
Part of the reason why it's interesting that supporters of the Vice President, Joe Biden, are still talking and preparing for the possibility that he'll get in. I mean, earlier today, Clinton saying he'll do whatever he needs to do. And, you know, indications are that at some point next month, maybe as far as into November now, he will make a decision on what exactly he should do.
Susan, what about Bernie Sanders and his campaign? We are always talking about how he's doing well, but, I mean, what's his next stage for Bernie Sanders?
Well, you know, I think he's won the battle, but he may well lose the war. He's won the battle in that he's pushed Hillary Clinton to the left. He's helped define the conversation on the Democratic side, and it's a conversation more on the issues that he wants to push, like income inequality, for instance. I think he continues to struggle with the idea that he is not a likely nominee, that the Democrats are unlikely to nominate someone who is the Democratic socialist from Vermont and 73 years old as their nominee, even if they're unhappy with Hillary Clinton.
Kimberly, what's your sense of the Republican attack against, let's say, Bernie Sanders is the nominee? There's a lot of sort of conventional wisdom like, oh, he'd be so much easier to attack than Hillary Clinton. But what's your sense about him as a target for the Republicans?
He would be easier to attack than Hillary Clinton. I mean, a lot of his views really are out there. But Susan makes a very valid point that what he has done is articulate the main messages that probably any eventual Democratic nominee are going to make on income inequality, the war on women, climate change, the environment, and things like this. The interesting thing when you look at Bernie Sanders is the question of how many people out there in the party really are passionate about a Bernie Sanders bid versus how much of that is a protest vote against Hillary Clinton. And those are the numbers that the Biden people, for instance, are looking at the moment, which is just waiting there for us to scoop up if we get in this race. Yeah.
All right. Thanks so much, Kimberly. Thanks, all of you. And we've fixed our satellite issue. The Republican presidential candidate and Ohio Governor John Kasich now joins us gleefully from Columbus. Welcome, Governor. Thank you. You heard some cheering when John Boehner's resignation was announced in some quarters. You've known him for a while.
Long time.
Yeah. Give us your reaction to his resignation.
Well, I'm saddened. I think John he's a great guy. He's in an interview sort of described it all, didn't it? It's a shame that people weren't seeing that earlier on. You did a very good job in the interview. But look, I was there in the 90s when we actually got things done. Think about it. We changed the welfare system, which had been in place for about 40 years. We balanced the budget, of which I was the chief architect. And we cut taxes, the economy was growing, and we were doing great. And when I left Washington, we had a $5 trillion surplus. And Boehner sat at the leadership table right next to me. And we pushed those things through, and that was some of the most productive time that Republicans or conservatives have had. Think about it. Balancing a budget, which people think is a fiction, reforming welfare, and cutting the capital gains taxes and creating economic growth. So, you know, we need to reflect on his accomplishments then and his accomplishments in rising and becoming speaker.
What about his, in terms of why that's harder to do today, what role do you think the group that he called were the false prophets in your own party, what role do you think the false prophets play in the current state of things?
Well, it's about inexperience. I mean, the people who keep saying that they want things to happen, what have they accomplished? What have they gotten done? They're serving in the Congress. Have they accomplished anything? You know, when I served there, we achieved things. I achieved things. You know, I was a reformer. I've been a reformer all of my lifetime. As you know, I shake up the system all the time. You know how much reform and change it took to balance the federal budget? I mean, I stepped on more toes than you can imagine. You know, coming to Ohio and reforming things out here, this state was about dead. Now we're doing well. People didn't think I could do it. You know how much we had to shake up? And so a lot of the people who were doing the complaining and saying, why isn't anything getting done? Maybe they ought to look in the mirror. What have they accomplished? I mean, are they just speech makers? Are they just people out there yelling and screaming? But, John, I have to disagree with your panel. When I travel around this country, and I was just in South Carolina, I was in New York, in Boston, in Iowa, you know what I know? Maybe people are yelling loud, but at the end of the day, people are now beginning to say, what can you do, Governor, to bring people together to accomplish things? So sometimes you hear loud voices out here who get, they're the ones that get the attention and get the headlines. Right? I got to tell you, at the end of the day, I believe the Republican Party will pick somebody who is a reformer, who is a change agent, but who has accomplished things and have experience. So all these people yelling and screaming, ask you, you ask them, what have you accomplished for the time that you've been in public office? Be an interesting question, wouldn't it?
It would, and we appreciate your help there on the question asking front. Let me ask you this, though. Two of the people who are now out of the Republican race, they did stuff, Governor Perry, Governor Walker. They had accomplished things. They had experience. They are no longer able to run for president. So what does that say about the climate in which you're trying to make the case that you just made?
Well, there's three things you need to be president, in my opinion, said by a smart Democrat. One, you got to have issues. Two, you have to have vision. And three, you kind of have to be likable. You got to have at least two of those three. And, you know, I think in regard to Scott Walker, he'll come back. He may be president someday. They just kind of got over their skis. They spent a lot of money and they ran out of money. You got to husband your resources. But what I have found, as you know, my campaign has gone on for slightly more than just 2 months, John. And, you know, I'm in the top tier in New Hampshire. I'm beginning to rise in Iowa. So if what I'm saying is not true, then I should be getting out of the race, which I am not, because I think we're making really good progress in connecting. But remember, people want change. They want reform. They want to see something done. But just carping about it and whining about it and making speeches about it doesn't get it done. America needs to solve problems. You know, in some ways, it's even a national security issue. When the world looks at America being unable to solve problems, they kind of laugh at us. And then they worry, is America failing? We need to be able to solve problems in this country and send a message to the world.
Let me follow on that theme. So there are now two groups, insiders and outsiders, sort of running in the 2016 Republican field. You've worked both in the public sector and the private sector. Those who are coming from the private sector who are running, are they making unrealistic promises about how they can come into office and just sort of whip it all into shape with their private sector know-how?
Well, look, I respect people who are in the private sector, but, you know, if you want to get things accomplished in government, you need to know how it all works. You need to know how you've got to maneuver things and bring people together. Now, I want to repeat one more time. Nobody has shaken up the system more than I have. A military reformer in a Republican Party, challenging my own party on balancing the budget and driving change, coming into Ohio where they said I was going to have to raise taxes rather than balancing the budget by cutting taxes. I've always been unorthodox in this and against the grain. But you know what? I know how to get it done. So again, John, if we elect somebody that doesn't know how to get it done, who makes a lot of promises, what have we achieved? Even if Republicans win, we have to solve the problems of immigration, of balancing a budget, dealing with entitlements, rebuilding the military. And by the way, when you rebuild the military, you better reform the Pentagon. I sat on that committee for 18 years, and I know the challenges in terms of delivering resources that get to the men and the women in the services and not into the bureaucracy. A lot of challenges out there. You know, the other thing I was struck by is you played that.
Governor, I'm afraid I'm going to have to interrupt you. We've run out of time.
Okay, we'll do it longer the next time, John.
Excellent. And I'll see you out there on the campaign trail. We really appreciate it. We'll see you soon.
I'll see you.
Before we go today, we want to congratulate one of our own. CBS News editor Mike Faulkner is celebrating 30 years of working for Face the Nation. Mike, we appreciate everything you do. Thank you. For Face the Nation, I'm John Dickerson. Today's guests were Speaker of the House John Boehner, Senator Bernie Sanders, and Ohio Governor John Kasich. The executive producer of Face the Nation is Mary Hager. The senior producers are Rob Hendon and Jill Jackson. This broadcast was directed by Sue Ann Stocky-Wayne. Face the Nation originates from CBS News in Washington. For more Face the Nation, we're online at facethenation.com, and you can follow Face the Nation, John Dickerson, and CBS Radio News on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Face the Nation is also rebroadcast on our digital network, CBSN, at 2 and 6 p.m. Eastern, every Sunday.